Right. Now, my first guest this morning is an author and a peace activist and is the chair of Uniting for Peace. He's devoted his life to the service of peace, humanity and our planet. His vision is to work together with civil society, international organizations and governments, and to work for a better world through the universal values of freedom, equality, solidarity, tolerance and human dignity. His new book is called The Economics of Killing: How the West Fuels War and Poverty in the Developing World. It is a fascinating read for those with a bit of knowledge. It's even more fascinating for anybody who this kind of stuff is new to. Good morning and welcome to Vijay Mehta. Good morning, Vijay. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you, Steve, for having me.
No, listen.
And hello to you and all your listeners.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Vijay. I have to say the work that you do is absolutely outstanding, and I take your hat off, my hat off to you. This book is first class, Vijay. One of the things I just want to make plain, I said this at the start of the show, but I don't mind admitting that over the last 20 years or so, my politics on my view of the world has changed, and therefore my politics have changed with it. And where you had the likes of C&D and peace organisations who back in the 80s, that as a young man I was quite anti, I now look at the world and think, what was I thinking back then? And wouldn't it be just a much better place if we could start working together, stop spending so much money on building up arms and start paying attention to other parts of the world that need that money. Now, that's my little piece over with. Let's have a little chat about this book. Now, The Economics of Killing: How the West Fuels War and Developing the and Poverty in the Developing World. We're going to talk about a few parts of this book, but can you first of all just start off by explaining to my listeners exactly what the military-industrial complex is?
Thank you, Steve. Thanks, first of all, for the compliments for the book and also explaining what the book is and also your own peace work. And by the way, I'm on the board of National Board of C&D as well. Okay, besides all other, I wear so many hats. Let's get on with your first question, which is the military-industrial complex. Shall we say, combination of companies who do both kind of work, which is manufacturing armaments and also civilian output. And what happened is, at the moment, the whole world is spending $1.6 trillion on military hardware, military weapons, etc. And the USA has got around 1,000 military bases around the world. They have to be serviced, the army over there, the bases, they have to be fed and everything. More importantly, recently, this military-industrial complex, like the U.S. with their allies, U.K., France, etc., Spain, they have gone to war recently in the wars in the Iraq and Afghanistan, which the running cost at the moment is $2 trillion U.S. dollars. And it is believed by the time we finish with the veterans and looking after the injured, etc., the cost overall could mount up to $4 trillion. That's not me speaking. It is the world-famous economist, the Nobel Prize winner, Joseph Stiglitz. So this military-industrial complex is sort of, shall we say, a combination of leaders, corporations, military generals, the whole of this set working together, which we can call military-industrial complex. Actually, the President Eisenhower warned us, and that was his parting shot as a president when he gave his speech, and he said, be warned of the military-industrial complex that will overtake you one day, and which, frankly speaking, is now. And that's why, being a peace activist all my life, I thought the world is becoming dangerously militarized, and more and more the countries and leaders are resorting to war to, instead of dialogue and diplomacy to solve disputes. But as the interview goes along, if you like, and let me say more about Milton Industrial Complex in the sense that what are the results of this monster, what I call Milton Industrial Complex. It did not be suffering and the killing and the violence in the wars. It is also the cause of extreme poverty in the developing world and of 9/11 and the market crash of 2008. And the whole essence of the book is how can we move away from this monster, the war economy, to a sustainable peace economy, which is based on soft power and cooperation.
Okay,
and frankly speaking, we've got more urgent things to solve, like tackling the biggest threats facing humanity, which is extreme poverty, climate change, and warmongering. So in short, that is the explanation of this book.
Okay. Now, thank you for that. Now, we're going to talk about 2008 in a second, which you just touched on there. But the first thing that a lot of people would say to what you have just said there is, well, is it any different now to the way it was 100 years ago, 200 years ago, when you put it, you know, when you scale it back to the way that economics were back 200 years ago and the way that the planet was set, the world was 200
sure.
years ago?
Sure.
Have things really changed, Fiji? It's always been that way.
You have raised a very valid point, important point, that if the world today looks exactly the same or something similar to what it was 100 years ago. But the difference, I would say, between then and now, that I would think that we have become more educated, more civilized, and we know the difference between right and wrongs. And for me, the whole crux of this book is how can we make sure, or how can we make progress so that the coming generations, we at least leave the world as it is and ensure the continuation and progress of our, I would say, sacred civilization and humanity. And the only way we could go through is not through by perpetual wars. If you see the history of war from Vietnam to the Korean War to the Cold War and the rest, and now coming to Iraq and Afghanistan. So we've been running around and behind what Eisenhower said is the military industrial complex, because they do need to, for them to manufacture weapons and armaments, they need either perpetual wars or a construct or a hyped up fear, like we have got a perfect one in terrorism, that is a unended war or an open and ended, what we can say, in which it gives all the countries in the world a added reason to arm themselves to the hilt, because the reason being perpetrated by the army to the leaders and the generals and the corporations is, oh, we got terrorism. We might have bombs near the Olympics. You can see what's happening in Olympics in London.
Yeah.
I mean, they have got a preparation as if it was there will be a war in London in July 2012 and not the Olympics games.
Okay. Yes, we can see that. I can accept that. Now, again, to come back, some would say, well, if it wasn't for the massive amount of arms that we had that the East and the West had during the Cold War, then the world would probably be a very different place today. It
agreed.
Kept the peace.
Yeah, agreed. Yes and no's in this game. First of all, when we knew that Japan was going to surrender, there was no need to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki with atom bombs, killing 140,000 people, innocent people, 100,000, and of whose ramifications we are still having with children, deformed children, other things. When we come to Hitler and others, was there any way we could have solved the situation? By the way, I'm a peace activist. I'm a peacemaker, peace builder, peacekeeper. But I'm not a pacifist, because there may be in circumstances in the world where we may need to use force. But as the United Nations and others have formed treaties and agreements, that should be the last option after all other venues have been explored and exhausted, like the diplomacy, like for Syria. Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General, is in Syria and is hammering out a peace plan between Syrians and their own citizens. Can you believe this, that a regime killing their own people? So there are ways and means in which we can settle disputes. The other thing I would like to point out, Steve, is to your listeners, that if war had solutions, we would have been out of Afghanistan, out of Iraq. But no, the U.S. is getting out because there's the election year, and they have got to show to their own citizens that we are coming out, we are not spending any more money. And Iraq is still, every week or every other day, there is a suicide bombing. So we have left Iraq. When we say we, the U.S. and the West has left Iraq. But the Iraq is not a solved situation. It's not come back to normal by any means. So you can see there are no... If we say that peace may not work or will not work, are there any military solutions? There are no military solutions as well. You can bomb a country up to the hilt, or you can kill people, but that is not... You are making more enemies, as we know, in Afghanistan and other places. And you are in other words, military options will never be a long-term solution.
Okay, well, let's have a look, kind of, as about what's going on in Afghanistan and the byproducts of that, which you've just touched on. And that is, people argue it's breeding future terrorists. Now, I'm talking about the West, went into Afghanistan initially to rid it of its its Al-Qaeda training camps. That was the reason that we were given. Now, what do we do, Vijay, about terrorism? Because there is an element in the East that just has no time for the West at all. And there's an element of Islam that has, extremism, which has no time for the West at all. What do you do with them? Because they are intent on destroying our civilization. How do you stop that?
Well, to me, the only way is to have... Okay, you touched on Afghanistan. Only way you could deal with Afghanistan is putting all parties in the dispute on the table. I mean, go a bit further on Afghanistan. Put it on the table. You have to talk to Taliban. Why? I tell you, Steve, that... we have a perfect example of the IRA, paramilitaries, and others on our doorstep in Northern Ireland and Ireland. And my office is in East London, and there is a bomb fell not far from me, and the whole building shook, and we came out. Now, the situation is that after the IRA and others themselves came to realize that the violence is not working, they will always have two Ireland. They stopped the violence, and after the 9/11, the funding stopped and things like that. But beside that, the positive thing is that they had this Good Friday Agreement, the Northern Ireland peace process. And with give and take, it's working. You can see prosperity has come back to Ireland. It's a different Ireland if you go there. Of course, the walls are there. I've been to Northern Ireland in Belfast and spoken to hunger strikers. I've spoken to prisoners. And at that time, when they were in prison, that was fine. They were doing something for a cause. But they themselves say we are in a better world. So things. And the other thing to remember is the sworn enemies, the IRA, the Sinn Féin and Protestants, Catholics and others, who would not talk to, wouldn't go to each other's side of the city, are sitting together in the assembly and working together for the better of their own country. So that's a perfect example to take to if you need to solve Iraq or Afghanistan and other countries. There is no other option but to bring all the, and even in the Middle East situation, you've got to bring Hamas, you've got to bring Hezbollah, you've got to bring the Israelis, the Palestinians, you've got to bring everybody on the table. And unless and until you don't do it and hammer out a plan, that is the way to live in a peaceful future for all. It's no good. People can't go to work, and the Israelis turn the tap off, the Palestinians can't get access to water, and that is not the world we want to live in. But again, Steve, it's a bit more than what I'm saying, because other interests of the countries and their own narrow agenda comes in the way and become obstacles to these solutions. Yeah.
But that's what I was just going to come to there, because it's all very well saying great words, you know, let's sit down and let's talk, but there's other agendas at play which you detail in the book, and you know, and which you touched on right at the very, very beginning when I asked you the question of what is the military industrial complex. And there's, you know, if you look back to the Bush administration with some of the players behind the scenes there, or not that much behind the scenes, who were pushing their own agenda for what they called America's interests. And there was a fascinating program on BBC Two last night on the WikiLeaks situation, and looking at America and how America behaves. Now, it's not just the United States. It's
United States we call a leader. That's what I say in my book, The Economics of Killing, that U.S. has got 4% of the world population, and friendly neighbors, Canada and Mexico, that spends more on the military, $700 billion. Than the rest of the world, which is seven times more than the China's budget. So, and it's become an obsession in a way that it is the military industrial complex is working, is out of control, okay, first of all.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's working not against interests of everyone, including the U.S. citizens, because they wouldn't have gone into this crash if they had these trillions which they are spending unwisely on wars. If they had left it in cash into their own country, they wouldn't be suffering an unemployment, job losses, and.
But Vijay, would that be the case? Would that be the case? Because the arms industry itself and the players that provide to the arms industry are creating employment, jobs, and wealth in their own way back in the United States.
Wow, that's sort of a myth, because even in UK, the same arguments here in UK are brought about by the military and the leaders and everybody. But that is a myth. I'll give you one example that we had in UK. We had a very thriving coal industry, but we haven't hardly got a coal industry in UK. But then at that time, the same arguments were put forward that, oh, what will happen to these hundreds of thousands of people? They're all gone to, engineers have gone to other companies, and so have been workers, and they're all been placed in other departments. The answer to that is what you just said, Steve, that first of all, we need to demilitarize and put the money in development and democracy. And I will give you five examples how it can be done. First of all, let's gradually dismantle military industrial complex, and you can shift workers from war industry into green collar jobs like renewables, waste management, pollution control, carbon capture. In short, in other words, cleaning up the world. Secondly, we can share this technology with the developing world, because they don't need to do what the U.S. and us in the West did, 100 years of burning coal. they can straightway go to these technologies. And that will be a great money earner for in the West and U.S., giving the poor countries the technology they need for energy security to industrialize themselves. And then I would say closed on the corruption, which is well known in the arms industry. Remember the $43 billion BAE Al Yamama arms deal to Saudi Arabia?
Yeah.
In which BAE had to pay $400 million in fines for false accounting, misleading statements, etc. And above all that, Tony Blair shut down the inquiry started by the Serious Fraud Office on the grounds of national security. Could you believe it? And all this was going to... bribes were going to Prince Bandar bin Sultan, son of Saudi, I believe he was the defense minister at that time. And the fourth, we should adopt the Chinese model. Why? Because I say, it's all in my book, by the way, in the Economics of Killing, that they have lifted 600 million out of poverty, despite corruption. And India is another great example. How they did it? They protected growth of state champions in developing countries. And we, in the West, we should stop offering aid programs with strings attached. In other words, we give you aid, we buy arms. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. And of course, we've got to strengthen that. The last point is, we have to strengthen the world institutions like the United Nations. Instead of marginalizing them, we should give them a better role to play. Same with World Bank, IMF, and others. We need to give them, and also some world institutions need to be dismantled, like the NATO, who are just trying to find new reasons to go to war from one country to the other.
Well, NATO,
these kind of arguments have to be taken into account if you want to seriously go away from war economy to peace economy and have a better world.
I mean, NATO's reason to exist stopped at the end of the Cold War, I would have thought. I mean, that was the whole reason for building NATO. Yet it still ploughs on. NATO is probably one of the... that's one organisation that does belittle the UN and twists everything at the UN for its own agenda. Are we reliant then, Vijay, on the new countries that are coming forward? You touched on China, the likes of Brazil, you know, the new economies that are up and rising. Are we reliant on these ones to start changing the future and working with and giving more credence to the UN and more aids to the UN? Because I read in your book, I couldn't believe this figure, if I've got it right, NATO spends 60 times what the total UN budget is on arms. You know, so are we reliant on... nothing's going to change... NATO aren't going to change things. We're relying on that falling apart and a new world order, and I don't like using that expression, but the likes of the new up-and-coming economies to change things.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I would totally agree with you that NATO is an organization we should have been dismantled long time ago, because it's got no reason to live. It was in the Cold War, and it was started to defend the West and the U.S. against the Russian fear of Russian invasion, things like that. So, first of all, that should be done. And you're already right, it's 60 times more, because the UN budget in 2010 and 11 was 7.1 billion, which, by the way, is less than the half, or is actually half the cost of the London Olympics, or if you want to know, then the US citizens spend more money on flowers and potted plants. And also the budget of Tokyo Fire Brigade is more than the UN budget. And UN is supposed to look after or take care of all the problems in wars and violence and tensions and conflicts, along with other problems. They have to take care of it. So that, I think, Steve, it's a question of perverted priorities of spending in this world, that where we should be spending more money is on education, health care, poverty reduction, tackling the climate change crisis, things like that. But leaving that aside, the agenda of the corporations and leaders and others is to go to one war to another, and and we are living in a situation where the world is so much militarized that people can't see the way out. But again, if we have to have the survival of the our civilization, humanity, and if we want to leave a lasting legacy in this world, then the people who know and believe and work for peace, and they know that is the right way to go. They need to work like people like me, yourself, and others, and your listeners. They need to put forward, make this debate a bit more, or shall we say, make a bit more noises, or act against the military mindset, and start and activate a political discussion to change the system for a safer planet, which is the only way to lead to peace and prosperity, as we have discussed. There is no military solutions to any problems in the world.
Okay, well, I agree wholeheartedly with what you say, Vijay. And, you know, you said education there. And one thing that people can do is to start making themselves more aware of what the situation is. And it will make them stop and think, and becoming more aware, they can then start putting pressure on spreading the word with their friends, and start putting pressure on politicians and so on and so on. And maybe that's how we can change things. There's no better place to start than getting a copy of your book. It's called The Economics of Killing: How the West Fuels War and Poverty in the Developing World. It really is a fascinating read. Vijay Mehta, thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
Bye-bye
thank
for
you
now.
Very much.